All right, we'll call the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee to order. We'll take Senator Prutner-Soland first. I don't see Senator Cook in the room. Senate File 3605.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 3605 basically amends the titles and duties of the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force. This change is necessary as the state of Minnesota continues to pursue increasing reliance on renewable energy resources and ensures that the state meets our greenhouse gas emissions reductions goal that we passed into law last year. The current Legislative Electric Energy Task Force statute calls for the narrow study of areas solely related to the electric generation sources and requires a study and reporting of many detailed obsolete issues that are no longer the primary focus of the legislature. Much of the information of the LEETF studies on an annual basis can still be studied under the jurisdiction of this new energy commission. The Legislative Energy Commission would expand its focus to evaluate all facets of energy resources and policies in working toward meeting Minnesota's emission reductions goals. And so Section 1, Subdivision 1 and 2 of the bill reflect the name change. They also established that members of the current LEETF will continue serving as members of the Legislative Energy Commission. Subdivision 3 replaces the LEETF's current duties with more pertinent duties for the broader scope of the Legislative Energy Commission. The new commission is charged with regularly evaluating the state's energy policies through a lens of environmental and economic sustainability. More specifically, the commission is required to study and analyze and make legislative recommendations related to several areas that are listed on page 4 of the bill. I can read them, but I think you can read them, too. And then the Energy Commission expires on the same date as the LEETF would have, June 30th of 2010. Section 2 allows the director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission to expend funds that are currently appropriate for the use of the LEETF for the use of the Legislative Energy Commission. So basically, it just takes the LEETF, changes the name, and expands the duties.
Thank you, Senator Prutner-Soland. Do you have any other testimony on your bill?
No.
Any question of members? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill.
Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves Senate File 3605 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prutner-Soland.
There are no finance. There's no fiscal note or anything. There's no finance changes to it.
I thought I saw one. The finance is requested that the director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission may expend funds
that
appropriated.
Is,
I don't know.
Mr. Chair, that's already an existing law.
It's underlined as if it were new.
Oh, I see. It's
on page 6, line 32. I mean, finance has requested it.
Okay. Okay.
So if, you know, we can fix it up on the floor. Is there anyone in the audience who cares to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill on the jurisdictional issues within the purview of the State and Local Government Committee regarding the makeup of the task force and the study, I believe, would be under there, too, the continued study? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman renews his motion that Senate File 3605 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you,
Prutner-Soland. Okay. Senator Mary Olson, Senate File, or House File 2932. Is that Senate File? Uh-huh.
No. House File. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here today on behalf of House File 2932. And with me at the table is Terry Greenside, who's the township supervisor for Deer River Township. And basically, this is a bill that requests that the township be allowed more latitude in terms of being able to deal with issues it has in related to the maintenance and upkeep of its cemetery. I have received a letter from Ken Solom, who's the general counsel for the Minnesota Association for Townships, and he says that while they haven't had time to take a formal position on the bill, it is consistent with the Minnesota Association for Townships' overall general policies by providing greater flexibility to town boards regarding the use of funds for township cemetery repairs and special maintenance projects. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to be able to turn the microphone over to Mr. Greenside.
Well, I mean, maybe we should find out if there's questions of members. I mean, I think that you pretty much covered the matters that were under the purview of this committee. Any questions of members? Seeing none, Terry, Mr. Greenside, welcome to the committee, and brevity would be very appreciated. I think that we pretty much understand what we're looking for here.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure you know where I'm coming from, Senator, when I say our townships have over the years collected the dollars. Now we want to spend some of those dollars to care for those permanent or those sites that we have in our cemetery, and this is a respectful thing to do. We continue to levy dollars for the routine maintenance, but we want to go through our cemetery, and this legislation will give other townships that authority too to level and straighten the stones to fill in the graves from the pioneers that have gone on before us. It's a community effort that our whole community supports, and I think if it passes, a lot of cemeteries can benefit from this.
Thank you, Mr. Greenside. I do understand the need for this, and I'm very sympathetic. Any questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves that House File 2932 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. Recommended to pass, period. Anyone else from the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to House File 2932? Seeing none, on Senator Vickerman's motion, all those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Thank you
very
Senator
much,
Olson.
Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Dibble, I saw in the room, Senate File 3093.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 3093. It's a fairly simple bill. What it would do is expand the time frame for contracts that public housing authority, local governments, are able to enter into from 15 to 20 years in order to facilitate the financing of energy efficiency improvements. This was brought forward by the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority and the Minnesota chapter of the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, otherwise known as NARO. Have requested this amendment because of the way the financing agreements and approvals work in relationship to HUD and the dollars that they use and the financing that they use from HUD. Mr. Chair and members, the nature of these improvements are such that they can be fairly extensive renovations to the buildings, high capital costs. In order to finance these improvements, they would need a term of 20 years versus 15 years. That's how the federal regs work, and our state laws hamper that because they speak specifically to 15 years. And so that's our goal. That's the problem, and that's the solution we're seeking. We have from the Public Housing Authority in Minneapolis, we have John Plifka and Bob Boyd, who can share some more information or answer questions.
Okay. Maybe we'll see if there are any questions. Anyone, any members have any questions of Senator Dibble or the testifiers? Sure. Senator Roebling.
What types of improvements are being installed? 20 years is a pretty long time. They have to be kind of major capital improvements. And so I'm just wondering what those are.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. They are major capital efforts, very capital intensive. They would need the longer term. I can have, sometimes it's HVAC, sometimes it's building envelope, sometimes it's much, much more extensive than that. It's in somewhat contrast and variance to another bill I'm carrying, which has in mind some of the lower cost sorts of improvements, another financing mechanism that would would take much less time, but for the greater. Plus, you know, it's this interaction with the federal dollars and how exactly those come forward, and those are typically for 20-year terms. So, but Mr. Boyd can answer these more
Mr.
specifically.
Boyd, would you care to elaborate?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I'm Bob Boyd. I'm with the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority, and with me, as Senator Dibble said, is John Plifka, Director of our Facilities and Development Department. The critical issue for us is that the federal government passed a law in August of 2005 that allows us to use up to 20 years, and Minnesota state law, which we're also subject to, limits us to 15 years. The additional 5 years can have an estimated $10 million impact on our effective scope of work that we can do under this. So that 5 years means $10 million to the Public Housing Authority. And as Senator Dibble mentioned, we do extensive remodeling of 41 high-rises, 780 scattered sites, 184 family units, which have an estimated asset value of $600 million. The federal government provides us approximately $13 million a year for capital improvements, and under this ESCO agreement, we believe within the next 2 years we can do an additional $40 to $50 million worth of work. That will save us substantial money because those limited capital dollars have to support our most recent study that estimates we have $222 million worth of unmet capital needs. So that 5 years and that additional $10 million presents us with ample opportunity. Some of the things we can do with the additional 5 years that we couldn't do without the 5 years because of the limited payback are all exterior lighting, which is essential to security issues for our seniors and our low-income families and also the surrounding neighborhoods. Small things such as interior lighting on medicine cabinets, which greatly impact our ability of our thousands of seniors who live in public housing to see. And then there's some more comprehensive work, such as the caulking and sealing to our envelopes for the buildings, all the facades outside the buildings. Again, we have 41 high-rises, and if those begin to erode and are not timely repaired, then the costs become exponentially more as the years go on. So we are able to do that, make those kinds of repairs with the additional 10 years. The other thing is, you all probably are aware, the Public Housing Authority currently under HUD's own formula is funded at 84 cents to every dollar that HUD says we need for effective operations. In addition, our capital fund has been reduced by tens of millions of dollars over the last 10 years or so. And finally, the Minnesota legislature has recognized the need to preserve the public housing developments that we have. And last year, through your efforts, you came up with $5 million statewide in order to support the capital investments of public housing authorities. Of that, MPHA received $500,000, which we're very appreciative. But today, with the stroke of a pen, instead of allocating dollars, you can not only allow us to do the 30 to 40 million that we're hoping to do, but do an additional 10 million, and it will not cost the state any money. So we think this is prudent. We think it's wise. It allows us to structure the monies we receive from the federal government that would have to go toward these energy savings into other areas and meet highly important capital needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, Mr. Plifka, did you care to add anything, or did that cover it pretty well?
That took care of it.
All right. Senator Day.
Chair, I would love to move one of Senator Dibble's bills. This is just a wonderful bill.
Senator Day moves that Senate file 3093 be recommended to pass. With that motion before us, anyone else in the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 3093? Seeing none, we have the Day motion before us. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Day. The next bill is my reelection bill. I want you to come up.
Oh.
So this is a very, very, this is probably the most important bill of the session, Mr. Chair.
We spent a good deal of time on this.
Thought transportation was a big deal. Or the energy bill from last year. So I have Senate File 2232, Mr. Chair, which would simply allow a city of Minneapolis in this case, which is the most interested, to undertake a process to adopt an ordinance which would allow folks to have their dogs accompany them in outdoor sidewalk seating areas for restaurants and cafes. Currently, under Minnesota rule, health department rules, they don't specify outdoor, indoor. They just simply talk about food service establishments. And of course, the city is not at all interested, nor is anyone interested in allowing any old dog to come inside a restaurant. That's a different matter altogether. But this would allow the city, through an ordinance process, so to deal with all of the questions that people might have about whether or not it's advisable for dogs to sit in outdoor cafes. But the truth is, Mr. Chair, it happens now. So it needs to happen under slightly more controlled circumstances. Some cities are unaware completely that this isn't even allowed, and they simply permit it outside of health department rules. With that, Mr. Chair, I have...
Do cities have ordinances allowing it, or do they just, they're just permissive? They just...
I'm not sure, but I know that St. Paul just kind of allows it to happen. I don't think they speak to it at all.
Mr. Chair, it depends Senator on Day. What size dogs they're bringing along.
Yes.
That's a good question. Mr. Chair, I have Councilmember Lisa Goodman from Minneapolis who can speak more about this as well. I think
City Council member?
Minneapolis City Council member Lisa Goodman.
Chair, Senator Lurie, members of the Senate, thank you for allowing us to be here today and take a moment of your time. I realize this isn't the most pressing issue in front of the legislature, but it would allow us to have clarity surrounding a practice that is pretty prevalent throughout the city of Minneapolis. Right now, the restaurant owners are unaware whether or not this is actually allowed. So most of them allow dogs in sidewalk cafes. The truth of the matter is the city of Minneapolis regulates sidewalk cafes. So if we would be able to enact an ordinance that would allow this, we could then regulate it through our existing sidewalk cafe provisions. And that's what we're seeking. This is a double opt-in. So first, local governments, other cities, for example, could opt in, and then the individual owners of the establishments would opt in after that. So no one would be forced to allow dogs on sidewalk cafes, and no cities would be forced to do this as a result of this legislation. I will note there is absolutely no enforcement right now. So it's illegal, and the state has said it through a rule that you can't do it, but there's no state health inspector out saying you can't do it, and animal control has more important things to do, and clearly the Minneapolis police have more important things to do. So there's no regulation of it at all. If it was allowed, we could regulate it through our existing ordinances. So this is important to the city so that we can take something that's currently happening and make it work better.
Thank you, Councilor Member Goodman.
Mr.
Any
Chair.
Questions of members? Seeing none, did you wish to offer some testimony as well, or did that cover it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Hendrickson, and I own Downtown Dogs, which is a dog care facility in Minneapolis. We care for about 150 dogs a day, and I am here with Councilmember Goodman to ask for your support of this bill for several reasons. The first is the business owners really want this because the economy is slowing down, as we all know, and if people have to rush home to let their dogs out or they're feeling guilty about their dogs, they're going to rush home. If they can have their dog there with them, they'll stay out longer and go out more often, spending more money, so something that would be really helpful to the business owners. And it's also something that the citizens want, because when dogs dogs are out, they're socializing. Socialization greatly increases dogs' behavior. It decreases behavior problems that bother everyone, like barking. So it makes them better canine citizens. So we're asking for your support because there's no downside. There's no one it hurts, and it only helps everyone.
Thank you very much. Any other questions of members?
Mr. Chair, no, just
Senator Vickerman.
Of a comment. This must be the year of the dogs. Dangerous dogs.
Yeah, there's no breed-specific bans
yesterday,
in here, is there?
Treatment.
Okay, we need to clarify that every time dog provisions come before us.
Mr. Chair, I hope it's not a vehicle for some bad idea like that. But they are debating chiropractic care for animals in another
Senator
committee
Larson
right now.
Moves that Senate file 2232.
Soon to be the omnibus dogs bill.
Yes, the omnibus dog bill. Be recommended to pass. Is there anyone in the audience who cares to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, we have the Larson motion before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Good. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We'll take up Senator Saxhog. You ready with House File 2788? Ready.
House File 2788 is a bill that will increase the City of Nashwauk's Public Utilities Commission from 3 to 5 members. The reason for this is, as you're probably aware, there's a $1.8 billion steel plant that's going to go on just out, well, actually, it's part of the City of Nashwauk, and included in that will be a 24-inch natural gas line, new electric substation, and they'll be providing water and sewer to the plant. I have a resolution from the City of Nashwauk signed by the mayor, if anybody would care to see it. Otherwise, I guess I think that this is a prudent move, and that I think they need probably a few more eyes and hands and ears with this project coming on board right now.
Thank you, Senator Saxhog. Any questions of members? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, do the commissioners get reimbursed or paid, or is there per diem, or how do they get compensated?
Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Roebling, it's been my experience on the Iron Range that it's on a per diem basis that the public utilities gets paid, yes.
So Mr. Chair, it's
Senator
it's
Roebling.
Nominal.
Increase. Nominal. It is nominal.
Any other questions of members?
I'll move the bill.
Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that House File 2788 be recommended to pass. Anyone from the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, we have the Larson motion before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair
Saxhog.
Members. Will that go to the floor then?
That goes to the floor.
Thank you.
Is Senator Rummel in the room? Oh. Are we going to take somebody else?
Mr. Chair, members, I am bringing to you a biomass bill at Senate File 2996. This bill came to me from the Met Council. Basically, the bill amends the definition of biomass to include organic compounds of wastewater effluent. And you'll notice the technical language in there. We worked with the Isaac Walton League and the ITAP, and I forget who that is, agriculture program, what is ITAP? Institute of Trade and Agriculture on this. And so we've redefined biomass because, according to the Met Council and many others, the wastewater treatment plants in our state are a rich source of energy savings, and they could not participate in the Renewable Development Fund grant dollars because of the definition not allowing biomass. The part that relates to this committee is the extension on page 4, line 4, of an advisory committee, which was due to expire in 2008. It will now expire 2010.
Senator Rummel, I believe that's the only provision in here that is under the jurisdiction of this committee,
that's
correct?
That's right.
Okay.
But it's an exciting possibility. The technology that's happening mm-hmm. is happening so fast that the extension of this committee's work is necessary.
Good. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have no problem with extending the group. I just have a question. Can you get wastewater sludge into a dry form so that it can be burned and incinerated?
This is
Senator
this
Rommel.
Specifically. No, this will not be burned. This will not be burned. I participated this summer in a joint House and Senate hearing on energy, and in Shoreview, Dr. Ruin, who's a University of Minnesota professor, has developed a technology. Right now we use algae to clean wastewater, and there's certain species or strains of algae that when they die off, they do die off after they've cleaned the wastewater, you can harvest that algae and extract diesel oil with the same octane as diesel. And so he is poised right now to have a demonstration plant, and he has no source of funding, and he could get funding from the Met Council from the Renewable Development Fund if we change the definition. The other uses for biomass, and specifically it excludes incineration, would include fuel from sludge for use in methane from anaerobic digestion, use of the effluent for cooling water in ethanol plants, and more. This is why the committee is being extended. They are finding many uses for this predominantly organic waste in the wastewater system.
But and the incineration of wastewater sludge is explicitly prohibited in several exactly. occurrences.
Under the definition of a renewable, it doesn't mean plants, I don't know what else they will do with the biomass, but they can't claim credit for lowering their carbon emissions if they burn it.
Did you want to address something?
You good. Okay. I think...
Mr. Chair?
Did you care to add a brief... statement regarding this
sure.
question?
I'm Jason Willett. I'm finance manager for the Environmental Services Division of the Met Council. That's the wastewater utility for more than half of the state's sewered population. And just to be clear, we do actually burn some of the sludge now. We can dry it out and we do it. But that's not what this bill is about. We're not asking for any special provision for that. This relates to the energy provisions. And the definition of biomass that conveys small financial assistance, you know, by putting it in the 25% by 2025, that renewable energy standard. Another one relates to the utilities are allowed to use 5% of their CIP, their conservation improvement dollars, to assist biomass. Wastewater sludges and byproducts aren't eligible now, so they wouldn't spend any more, but they could choose to do it on wastewater. Wastewater sludges are predominantly organic, overwhelmingly. It's human waste, it's food waste that goes on the garbage disposal, and it's microbes. There is energy value, there's nutrients, and as the senator has discussed, we are working with the U to try and figure out how to best capture that with the algae research that Dr. Ruin is doing.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Roebling.
That sounds good to me. Anytime you can make something good out of sludge.
Yes,
I'm all
it's definitely it, renewable.
So.
We're all working on it all the time.
I'll move Senate File 2996. I'm not sure where it goes next.
It's going right to the floor. Thank you, Mr. Willett, for the clarification. Senator Roebling moves Senate File 2996 be recommended to pass. Anyone in the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, we have the Senator Roebling motion in front of us. All those in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Rummel. Senator Higgins,
hey.
Thank you for being so patient.
I'm good. How are you?
Good to see you.
although we're moving pretty good here.
You are
moving
at a fast and furious clip, Mr. Chair.
Senate file 3303.
And, Mr. Chair, there's an A1 delete all amendment, if someone would be so kind as
looks
to offer
like
that.
We have it in our
I'll move the
packet.
Amendment, Ms.
Senator
Good
Larson
chair.
Moves. Is this the first time this has been heard, Senator Higgins?
Yes, indeed.
This is an author's amendment. Then Senator Larson moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We now have Senate file 3303 in shape before us. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate file 3303 would allow the City of Minneapolis to establish a nonprofit riverfront development corporation to revitalize the Mississippi riverfront. Most people think of the Mississippi River as dividing St. Paul and Minneapolis, but in fact, it does that for quite a ways on the border, and then it comes and carves through Minneapolis itself. And I'm on the west side of the Mississippi, and Senator Pogermiller, for example, is on the east side of the Mississippi. And all along the Mississippi River, we have a very diverse feel to the river and different businesses and activities and some housing on
the... Senator Higgins, 1 second. I need clarification. I always look at Senate Counsel's summary. Is this of the delete all or is this of the bill itself, Senate Counsel?
Mr. Chairman, it's essentially... Yes,
it's the delete all? Okay. Press on. Then I'd like to members to know what they can be...
And, Mr. Chair, you can tell that because the effective date wasn't in the original.
I believe you. I'm just trying to...
Anyway, so part of the riverfront is very expensive housing, for example, and then other parts of the riverfront are looking kind of tacky and really need somebody to pay some attention to it to revitalize that part of the riverfront. So as you can see in the bill, this sets up a board of directors that allows the board to have employees. The bill states, you know, the makeup of the board. It allows the City of Minneapolis to provide office space, administrative support, and so on to help create and establish the corporation. Section 3 says that the city will prepare a report to the chairs of the committees and divisions with jurisdiction over metropolitan government on how the corporation is doing, and then the effective date is interesting. It's both the City of Minneapolis and the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board have to sign off on this, and then we state in there that they must do this by the end of 2008 or it all goes away. I have with me here, to my immediate left, Councilmember Diane Hofstad from the 3rd Ward in Minneapolis, and Minneapolis Park Board Commissioner Scott Vreeland from District 6.
District 3.
South Minneapolis. And they were part of the Blue Ribbon Task Force that studied the revitalization efforts that we should undertake in Minneapolis, as was I. And I'm sure they have much more that they can tell you if you would like.
First off, let me ask if there's any questions of members at this point. Senator Pappas.
But Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, as long as you offered, you know, we've had a riverfront corporation, nonprofit riverfront corporation, St. Paul, for many, many years, and I'm surprised that Minneapolis hasn't had one, and I'm thrilled to see that you're doing this. You'll find that it really helps to kind of focus your work to have an entity out there outside of the city that's all they're focused on is improving your riverfront. So
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, we talked about your Riverfront Corporation a lot.
And I've been on it for many, many years.
Well, good. With that, Councilmember Hofstad, Mr. Vreeland, any additional testimony you'd like to offer?
Only to thank Senator Pappas for kind words and the committee members for hearing this today and our sponsor, Senator Higgins, who is event. I'm Diane Hofstadt, council member for the 3rd Ward, the City of Minneapolis, and thank Senator Higgins and all of the members, and I'm here with Scott Vreeland from the Parks Board. This is an example of cooperation between the City of Minneapolis and the Parks Board to look more creatively at how we manage our river and our river benefits that we have. And we see this as an opportunity not to coordinate, not only to coordinate our planning, but also to do fundraising and advocacy on behalf of the river and to implement in the various projects as we move forward. And we've looked very carefully at the success of St. Paul. I have met with our partners in St. Paul. They are supportive, and we've learned much through that riverfront organization. And not that we're copying, but we certainly think that is distinctive and a means for us to move forward in this direction. We think that this is an opportunity to develop one of the best areas in our state, and that's our riverfront. And so we're looking forward to your support,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Hofstadt. Senator Pappas.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, and although I don't recall us coming to the state to create the corporation. And so why do you need to come to the state? Maybe we didn't. It was so long ago, 25 years ago, that I
Council
I
have any?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, the law requires cities who want to set up corporations to come to the legislature.
Oh, okay.
Now,
so we must
before 97, that wasn't the case. But since 1997, it's a requirement.
Oh, it was before 97.
Right.
So you, and then, excuse me, Mr.
Senator
Chairman,
Pappas.
Those who already existed didn't have to come to the state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, there were hundreds that existed before 97.
They were grandfathered in.
They were grandfathered in. They were required to conform to certain requirements that local governments have to comply with. But they were basically grandfathered in if they were created before 97.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
So was this, did we have some kind of scandal or something that we did this, or why did we do this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I don't know it was a scandal, but there was a discovery that there were hundreds of these that had been, that had been created before 97 with virtually no legislative
oversight.
So they're doing all kinds of things that they couldn't have done if they were the political subdivision itself.
All right, I gotcha.
Yes, if I could add. My name is Scott Vreeland. I'm a Park Board Commissioner for the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board.
Welcome.
I'm also a commissioner for the Mississippi Watershed Management Organization, one of the jurisdictions in this area. And I've been working on this for more than 12 years, and one of the really exciting parts about this is that both the City of Minneapolis and the Park Board have approved plans for the Upper River, the Above the Falls Master Plan, to transform the Upper River into contiguous greenways and a real resource for that part of the city. And I think that's a very important vision. This this development corporation that we're looking at would look at the entire river in Minneapolis, and that has its advantages as well. But this is a something I've been working on for 12 years, and it's, I think, very much needed to help us implement the plans that we have all approved and want to do. And this would be the best mechanism after working many hours figuring out how to do this best. We think this is the best mechanism to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Vreeland. Any questions of members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 3303 be, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Senator Larson moves that Senate File 3303, as amended, be recommended to pass. Anyone in the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, we have the Senator Larson's motion before us. All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you,
Senator
much.
Higgins.
Thank you.
Senator Vickerman, House File 2599.
Cook was here for a second.
I know.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, welcome.
House File 2599 is Memorial Day spending by the counties. Section 1 of the bill increases the amount a county board may spend for Memorial Day observance from $2,000 to $3,500. The amount was last increased in 1984 from 1,500 to the current 2,000. The second part of the bill, second section, two, increases from $100 to $300 the amount of a county board may appropriate to each post of a recognized military service organization or society will help pay the Memorial Day exercises. This amount was last increased in 1979 from $50 to the current $100. Both provisions would be effective on July 1st. Mr. Chair, before
that point, we've got an amendment before us here.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have that amendment, and it has to do with the dates, and I'm going to ask Mr. McGowan if you could.
Mr. McGowan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, it was just discovered if they want to take advantage of this Memorial Day, we have to have an immediate effective date. Otherwise, July 4th or July 1st is too late. So it just changes the effective date from July 1st till the day following final enactment.
And Mr. Chair, members, it's permissive. It doesn't say they have to. It says they may.
Right.
If the board decides they want to.
Senator Vickerman moves the A1 amendment. I think we all pretty much understand it. Any questions on that motion? Seeing none, on the A1 amendment, all those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. And we now have the bill before us. You're going to have to get the host to fix it too, I guess, huh, Senator Vickerman?
But well, Mr. Chair, I would move that House File number 2599 be recommended to pass. I'd like to put it on a consent calendar, but if you don't want to do that, we can put it on general orders.
It has to go to finance, isn't it?
It says to me it's going to the floor. The consent calendar sounds like anybody have any issues with this going to the consent calendar? It sounds okay to me. It's permissive. Counties wanting to appropriate a little bit more.
It's not state.
Lord, what have you guys been doing?
It's permissive.
Okay. Senator Vickerman moves that
what is this?
House File 2599, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar.
What's that?
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just sat down here for just a moment just so I know if I'm wanting something.
Yeah, take a minute.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Vickerman, you want to explain it one more time very quickly for Senator Gerlach?
There's a funding increase?
No. That's certainly not a consent calendar item. This is a permissive statute allowing counties that wish to spend a little bit more than they had historically been limited to for observation of Memorial Day.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach, that doesn't mean they're going to do it. It gives them the authority that they can hold.
Are you on a consent calendar that?
If you take issue with that, Senator Vickerman may withdraw his motion.
I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I think we should just be careful about consent calendar items. And we've been, sending a lot of things to consent calendar, but it doesn't mean it's not worthy and it's not going to pass. But
Mr. Chair, it's whatever this committee would like to do.
We're not doing this.
It's going to be your motion.
I can pass it on general orders just as fast, if that makes sense.
Senator Vickerman withdraws his motion that House File 2599 be placed on the consent calendar. And renews a motion that House File 2599, as amended, be recommended to pass.
And referred to the floor.
Yep. Recommended to pass goes directly to the floor. Anyone in the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill?
Or a win together, yeah.
Seeing none, we have the Vickerman motion before us. All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Vickerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Larson, did you want to go next?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman is here. She's on the committee.
Senator Ortman is here next. I think it'll be quick. Senator Ortman brings us Senate File 3451. Welcome to the committee, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good afternoon. Senate File 3451 is a bill that would authorize the county board to take over some of the duties previously the responsibility of the Carver County Library Board. It was the county board that appoints the members to the library board, and other counties have done this, Hennepin, Washington, and Scott County. I proposed to the Carver County Library Board last year that they consider this, and they've come back after consideration and drafting some language in support of this change. The county board and the library board are all in support of this. What it does is essentially says that the fiscal responsibility for managing libraries is the responsibility of the county board. The legal authority will be retained by the county board, but the library board will have responsibility for all of the policies, for the hours, for the selections, for essentially the capital improvement plan, so planning long term. And there is no opposition. We have worked with the library board and the county board to earn their support for this proposal.
And what do they do currently, Senator Gorman? How do they go about this currently?
Well, right now the library board has responsibility for the budget, and the county board has asked for the responsibility for all the fiscal matters.
I see. Okay. Are there questions? Senator Roebling.
Chair, and I remember when this bill came through last year for Scott County, but one of the surprise outcomes that we were not aware of at the time, and I don't know if the same situation in Carver County, is that after it took effect, the library employees were non-union. And when they came under the county board, they had to become unionized. And they were as surprised as anybody. And some of them weren't real happy about it, but they had to do it. It's part of the PELRA rules, apparently. And so I'm just wondering, do you know if your library employees are currently union or non-union?
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Ortman.
I believe they're all currently union. I don't think this will have that same impact in Carver County.
Further questions for Senator Ortman? Seeing none, Senator Roebling moves.
I wish I knew for sure if they
were
all unionized.
Then we'll have Senator Larson moves that Senate File 3451, there are no amendments, be recommended to pass. And there's been no request for this bill anywhere else. So we have Senator Larson's motion that Senate File 3451 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Larson. Let's skip a little bit. Senator Larson indicates he has an appointment he has to make. Senator Larson brings us House File 2896.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. House File 2896 would strike language that was passed in 1923 that requires a city to hold a referendum before adopting an ordinance to build a memorial to the veterans of the United States, a war memorial. And it's been on the books since 1923. I asked Mr. McGowan to do some research when I was looking into this issue because the city of Richfield is in the process of wanting to assist with the memorial that is proceeding for Chuck Lindbergh, who was the last living flag raiser at Iwo Jima. And so we couldn't find any legislative history other than that this was passed in 1923, and there hasn't been much discussion about it since. And so this would just not entirely repeal the law, would continue to require that certain a limit in terms of what the estimated cost is, a 10% cap over that, and also requiring that the minutes of the meeting that approves it reflects the cost to the city.
Okay. Are there questions for Senator Larson? I had forgotten to ask about Senator Ortman's bill, but is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak either in support of or in opposition to Senate File 2896?
House File.
House File, Senate 2896.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Larson, is this veterans group in Hopkins that's working on this? Or you said something about a group in Richfield.
Senator Larson.
Madam Chair, this issue came to me when the Richfield City Council, which was wanting to be helpful to a nonprofit organization, the City of Richfield, that wanted to build this memorial, and they found themselves limited by this law. And then when we looked into it,
seemed reasonable that we make it addressed statewide and not just an exemption for the Richfield project. I'm not familiar with the Hopkins project. Okay.
Any further questions? Senator Larson moves that House File 2896 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Larson. Senator Vickerman?
We did.
Oh, we did both of? Oh, I'm sorry. I just didn't mark it off. Senator Lurie.
Consent calendar here.
While he's coming forward, members, this is the last official meeting of this committee. There has been a request for an additional meeting on a bill for an informational purposes, which I will be holding. And we also have some other business. So we won't be hearing bills that are moving forward, but there will be other committee hearings. And we will let you know about them. And we'll also be having the pensions bill. So
okay.
This is
not the last.
This is not exactly the. I mean, it kind of is, but there'll be extraordinary circumstances under which we bring up have other hearings, including the pensions bill. And Senator Betzel, do you have any idea when that might be ready?
Well, Madam Chair, under joint rules, we have until the second committee deadline to get the pensions bill out of GovOps. I've talked.
That would be
to
today.
The majority leader and. Representative Murphy is talking to the speaker. We obviously realized because of the compactness of the session, we could not meet that. I don't know.
In the next couple of weeks, were you thinking?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. I think there's going to be a meeting of the Pension Commission probably next week, and so we should have something fairly soon for a bill. But we still have to have a joint resolution to extend the deadline out. But we'll let you know next week how it's looking.
And we have 22 confirmations to consider. So the committee will indeed be meeting. Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, are we going to go through all these bills, hopefully?
Yes, some of them are quite fast, and we are way ahead on our time.
Well, if Senator Koch doesn't come back,
I'm going to do her bill. I'm an author on her bill, and I'm going
to
be doing it.
Because that has to be passed. There's 900 guards left this week. So.
Senator Vickerman, I'm going to stand in for Senator Koch. We have it all worked out. As soon as I get to my bills, we'll be doing them. Senator Lurie brings Senate File 3571.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you said, I have Senate File 3571 before you. This is a very brief bill. It really creates an exemption in current statute for essentially DT&H employees. When state-operated services were started, there was put in statute a requirement that the employees of state-operated services, including these day treatment and rehabilitation programs, be run by state employees represented by a collective bargaining unit. Day treatment and rehabilitation providers have clients, though, that they have working. They go and clean hotel rooms in my particular DT&H, things like that, and they can't really be considered employees of the state in such a capacity. They need to be employees of the DT&H. So this is a saying that people who work at the DT&H, except clients who work within and benefit from the treatment and rehabilitation programs, must be state employees. And the importance of this is that the DT&H programs themselves need to be able to offer W-2s to these employees, and that will allow these employees then to be eligible for some of our public programs, specifically Medicaid for employed persons with disabilities, MAEPD services, that because of our current statute, they're not able to gain access to those public programs designed really for people in this situation. I have been working with AFSCME on this, the bargaining unit that represents state employees in the state-operated services, and they are actually in support of this measure. It'll help the clients being served a great deal.
Hey, are there questions or comments for Senator Lurie on Senate File 3571? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in support or in opposition to Senate File 3571? Seeing none. Senator Lurie moves that Senate File 3571 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Betzel, would you like to
do your bill
next, and then we'll do my bills last. Senator Betzel brings us Senate File 2403.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate File 2403 amends a current part of the statute that deals in Section 299A.465, which is health insurance for disabled firefighters and peace officers. The reason why we need a change here is because last year in the pensions bill, we changed how people can qualify for disability retirement. It was frankly too easy in some instances for people to qualify for disability, and so we made a number of changes. The council that had been in previously in existence to determine disabilities, they are going out of existence. We need some changes in the statute to help determine how individuals are going to get the health benefits when they are qualified for disability. There is an A2 amendment.
Is that a delete all?
It is a delete all. This is the first stop of the bill.
Is this the first committee?
Yes,
Senator Betzel
however,
moves an author's amendment that he's going to change.
I'm going to change one item here because on line 2.11, the words way of, I would like to strike that. Determination may be only determined by writ of certiorari. I don't need way of certiorari. Writ of certiorari.
So Senator Betzel incorporates in the A2 amendment the deletion on line 211, the words way of, so that the sentence reads by writ of certiorari. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. We have the A2 amendment. It's an author's amendment to delete all. All those in favor of Senator Betzel's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Betzel, do you want to continue describing your bill?
I'll just describe what the bill is. It's quite technical, but basically it defines how a retiree can qualify for health benefits because of a disability. As I say, there's a difference now because somebody who's disabled might actually go into a full retirement rather than a disability retirement. And so this just defines, consistent with the pension law change that we made last year, how they do that.
And this bill is appropriate to travel on its own rather than in your pension bill.
It's not a pension. The Pension Commission is aware of it. This is not really a pension bill per se. It's because it's a health benefits bill.
Okay.
The other process is that in order to, if somebody wanted to challenge a determination, they had to go before the Court of Appeals. This just requires that they have to go through a process for administrative hearing before they go to the Court of Appeals. That's what the second part of the amendment does. I've got Bill Gillespie and Ann Finn here, and also Mary Vanek from PERA is here as well, too, to talk on it.
Mr. Gillespie, did you want to speak about the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, several years ago, this legislature created the Public Safety Officers Panel to administer the Public Safety Officers Benefit Act, which was part of which granted insurance benefits, continuing insurance benefits for police officers and firefighters who were injured in the line of duty and were no longer able to perform those functions. That panel that you created sunsets July 1st of 2008. Therefore, we'll need a finder of fact to whether or not someone who still qualifies for this benefit. And that is the reason why the language refers directly to the PERA determination of duty disability. If you qualify for duty disability under PERA rules, then you would qualify automatically for this benefit. There would be no reason then to have the panel. They would be using a redundant form of determination. They would both be using PERA's duty disability definition because you couldn't get in front of the panel unless you had been granted a duty disability. So for that purposes, it answers the need for a finder of fact. And then, as Senator Betzel indicated, there are those who are not members of PERA but who would qualify for this duty disability related insurance benefit and who would need a way to get that duty disability determination, even though there may be a relief association. There are still relief associations around. They would need some way to access that benefit. And this provides for PERA to make that determination, indemnifies PERA from any cause of action relying to appeal, puts the appeal process on the employer and the employee to settle amongst themselves, and gives a process by which they can make that determination through an ALJ. So with that, I think, Ann Finn, I want to know that the MPPOA, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, is in support of this bill, and I would refer to Ms. Finn.
Any questions for Mr. Gillespie or comments? Seeing none, Ms. Finn, did you want to speak?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I don't want to be redundant, but I do want to get on the record that the League is supportive, and we appreciate all the efforts that went into this very important compromise on a technical and not very glamorous issue. So I do thank Senator Betzold and Mr. Gillespie for working so hard to get this put together.
Okay, are there questions or comments for Ms. Finn?
And I guess Ms. Vanek from PERA is here. She doesn't need to.
And yeah, Ms. Vanek is here if anyone has any questions for her. Seeing none, Senator Betzel rules that, moves that. He rules, right. He rules that Senate file 2403 be recommended to pass as amended. Senator
Gerlach. Yeah. So, thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question, but I also just want to say I just got a text message that apparently we're not hearing that bill on the floor of the Senate after committee. We're not hearing that health care bill. I just got a message on that.
Yeah. I'm just telling you. Oh, correct.
They already knew that.
I just assumed that from but I guess, does everybody know that we're not going to hear the health care bill today?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you,
Breaking
Senator
news.
Gerlach.
My question
but
is, Senator
Betzel. But I do think that the floor is, we're still in recess to receive committee reports. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzel, the bill here, did this go through the Pension Commission? I know you chair the Pension Commission, and I'm just wondering why this, I mean, shouldn't the Pension Commission be dealing with this as well and part of the pension bill that comes forth?
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, first of all, I do not chair it. The House has the gavel for this two-year period. I'm on the Pension Commission, but the next two-year period, the Senate will have the gavel. I think we ran it through the pension staff. This does not affect pension benefits. There's an existing statute that deals with health care benefits for people who are disabled firefighters who are retired. So this doesn't affect their benefits one way or the other, so it's really not an appropriate issue for the pension staff to be looking at or the Pension Commission to be looking at. So,
Madam Chair, perhaps I can
Ms.
help.
Finn.
This benefit is what we call continued health insurance for folks who go out on job-related disability. So this is really something where the employer is paying health insurance and the rest of it comes from the state once someone actually goes out on duty disability. So it's really a benefit that's outside of the purview of PERA.
Senator Roebling.
Okay. I'm just wondering, does this go on the rest of their life, or does it end when they're Medicare eligible, these benefits?
Senator Betzel. Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, this continues to age 65, at which point you would move on to the Medicare section.
And Madam Chair, that was part of the change that we made last year, because rather than having people be disabled and get disability pensions and benefits forever, they were going to retire at age 65 anyway. So at some point we convert them over to the benefits they would have gotten had they not been disabled.
Senator Betzel, any further questions or comments? Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 2403 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members.
Don Rules. Okay.
What's that?
Don Rules. I didn't know that.
Rules, yeah. It's always news to me.
Two left. I think we need to have any. They were planning to stay much past.
Senator Rest, welcome back to the committee. We're going to take up Senate File 3055 first, or
I'm going to do Senator Coach's bill first.
Yeah, Senator what?
Senator Coach's bill. Yeah. I am now a co-author on the bill, and because of the schedule that she was having to keep, I told her I would do the bill for her, particularly since she's already been in front of this committee with the bill. So this is a mere formality because the although we thought that and heard her bill, we believed that we had gotten a formal referral from the Business Industry and Jobs Committee, but it turned out that they had not done that. And that instead they had sent it to the floor. And so we heard a bill that we actually didn't have in our committee. So the bill came back to our committee to make sure that we're doing the procedures correctly. It does deal with a business loan program for small businesses that have been or it establishes a business loan program for small businesses that have been harmed by the military deployment of an essential employee. That's what it sets up. And there's $1 million appropriated to the commissioner for placement into a revolving account for the program. Let's see, why didn't this bill go to finance?
It's going to finance next, it looks like.
Beg pardon?
It's going to go to finance from here.
Oh, I didn't see the sheet. It shouldn't have gone to the floor to start with, I guess. Okay. And so there isn't $1 million appropriation to accomplish that. And the bill came to our committee because there was expedited rulemaking, and that's what Senator Coach spoke about when she brought it here. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 3055, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
We have Senator Rust's motion in front of us. Any questions from members on that? Seeing none, anyone from the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 3055? Seeing none, Senator Rust's motion that Senate File 3055, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to finance. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I take up Senate File 3072.
3072, we have an amendment, a delete all.
That's correct. I move the delete all.
This is an author's amendment, the
it's
first hearing of
A1
this.
A1 amendment.
This is the first hearing of this bill.
That's correct.
Senator Rust moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. We now have Senate File 3072 in shape and before us. Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 3072 is the companion bill to a bill that was brought to me by Representative Carlson, who is the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, and also one of the representatives in my district, and his bill number was 2554. Senator, Representative Carlson noted in looking at some of the information from the National Conference of State Legislatures that Minnesota was one of 17 states that did not have some provision for the legislature to participate in the calling of a special session. And so our bill calls for a constitutional amendment to be placed on the ballot that would allow for, under limited circumstances, for the legislature to have a process to call itself into special session for a limited amount of time. And that is what the A1 amendment accomplishes. First of all, that's different from the bill, that the in writing, a majority of the members of both houses would need to sign some sort of, I guess it would be almost a petition for a special session, or upon the order of the presiding officers, agreement of the presiding officers of the legislature, to convene in a special session, that it would do so on limited subject matter and that it could not exceed 7 legislative days. And so the question to be put to the voters would be, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to require the legislature to meet in special session for up to 7 days upon the agreement of a majority of the members of each house of the legislature or upon the order of its presiding officers. In the packet, there should be a letter from the League of Women Voters in support of Senate File 3072, stating that they believe that the bill does reflect the principles of good government that the League advances and is in the best interest of Minnesotans. So I hope that you would consider that as you look at the bill. There, and I can answer questions about have the information from NCSL about what goes on in other states. It certainly is a leveling of authority to provide for the legislature as well as the governor to take this important step when the legislature, absent the governor's decision, believes that it is important to take up a limited agenda for a limited time and call itself into special session. So, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for questions on the bill, or if members have questions about what goes on in other states. Most of the states that have a that are allowed to do this do not limit the length of a special session. They're about, 16 that do have a limit regardless of who calls the special session.
Thank you, Senator Rust. Any questions of members? Senator Roebling, and then Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm one of those people who doesn't really think this is necessary and has concerns that, and I guess I shouldn't be too concerned, but I have a feeling that the voters would not giving it the majority vote that it would need to pass. And one of the things I'm wondering, Senator Rest, is every constitutional amendment that has been successful has usually had a group of activists who would get out and raise some money and get the issue before the voters. And I'm just wondering, who do you think would be doing that in this case?
Senator Rest?
Well, I would certainly think that since the League of Women Voters, for one, is in support of it, that they would certainly publicize that among their members. But, you know, I'm not sure that who spends the most money on a constitutional amendment should be the basis on, or who could spend the most money on something should be the basis on which we would decide to place an amendment on the ballot. And maybe there wouldn't be a whole lot. By contrast, even though the bill didn't go forward and be heard in the Judiciary Committee, there was a lot of funding that was going to be available for the judicial selection amendment, and there may be a lot of money, both pro and con, going into the sales tax amendment. But it seems to me that we should be taking up other things that are, in my mind, and I appreciate that it might not, you might not think it's good public policy, and I accept that just because there's not a a huge hue and cry for something or a lot of money behind something, that we should not take up a good idea. And I think Representative Carlson in particular was very alert to everything with regard to the emergency nature, which is the first time we've really had an emergency that precipitated a special session with the bridge collapse, and that the legislature itself should be able to do that in another kind of emergency situation if it deemed it an emergency, and perhaps the governor did not.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Roebling, did you have further questions?
Mr. Chair, I was thinking about offering an amendment that would eliminate the on line 12 and on line 27 the phrase "or upon the order of its presiding officers." Well, on one it says "of both houses," but it's on the question that would be placed on the ballot and on the other one. So it would only be by a majority of the members of the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, I would support that amendment. If you want to offer it.
Do you want to?
Yeah, I would offer that amendment. Because, Mr. Chair, I just want to give you my reasoning for this, because, you know, otherwise.
What is the amendment before you can catch what the amendment is?
Oh, it would be after the comma on line 12, eliminate "or upon," and on line 13, eliminate "the order of the presiding officers of both houses." And then the question has to be changed on the bottom on line 1.27, "or upon the order of its presiding officers."
And
be eliminated.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I agree with that, because that's letting two people do what we're really trying to say ought to be something that the whole body, or at least a majority of the members of both houses. And although right now, the majority in both bodies is a single party. We know that the House has changed hands at least three or four times since I've been in the legislature, and it would not always be a single party that was dominating it. So I like that amendment. I hope members will support it.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Roebling,
what I was thinking is, a lot of times, you know, the majority caucus makes decisions for the whole body, but sometimes within the majority caucus, you barely have a majority. that agreed to it.
I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you may only have a little more than a fourth or a third of the legislature controlling the whole body. And so I guess that's why I would prefer to have a majority of the legislature and not just a majority of the majority caucus that would work with the majority leaders and decide what to do. I still don't know if I like the proposal, but at least I would improve it.
So
and Mr. Chairman, and there may be, even though it would be the, you know, it could be as few as 67 and 34, as few as 101 people, even within, again, even within the majority caucus, there might be people who don't agree. And there may be people of the other party who do agree. So they at least allow that without being just the presiding officers.
Mr. McGowan, the amendment as stated. Mr. Bodern, the amendment as stated works well.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, everyone have the understand the amendment. Any further questions? Seeing none, we have the amendment of Senator Roebling before us. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And the amendment is adopted. Senator Gerlach? Gerlach. I'll work on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a number of questions, Senator Rustin, I had a brief moment during lunch hour, at least to talk about this a little bit. So, my first question is, Senator Rust, we often ask this of bills that come before us. What problem is this trying to solve? And that's probably kind of a softball thing to start
in
with.
Senator Rust.
In my remarks, I mentioned that Representative Carlson, and I, you know, full disclosure, he brought the bill to me. It was his idea. What was particularly tuned in to a special session this past year called when there was an emergency, and that with the bridge collapse, and started thinking about, well, what if there were some sort of emergency where the legislature felt it should take some action, and that was not whatever it would be. I don't mean such a disaster as this. And that the governor may or may not have been in agreement with that, or even the timing of it, that the legislature should have the privilege, the same privilege as the governor had, or in this instance, a constitutional right.
Okay. Senator Gerlach.
This question maybe
it didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of the experience of the special session called, or of the disaster that we were experiencing in August.
Okay.
Senator Gerlach.
I have a question for counsel. The provision that's in the state constitution right now is just one line. Just says a special session of the legislature may be called by the governor on extraordinary occasions. That's the line. Questions for counsel. Is that line, is that original from 1858? I know the Constitution's been reworked over the years, but is that, do you know, I mean, is that the system we operate currently under for special sessions, is that what we've been operating under for a sesquicentennial amount of time?
Mr. Bodern, do you know an answer to that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gerlach, I don't have an answer to that offhand. It may have been affected by I think the Constitution was also, in effect, recodified in 1974. The language may have been moved around a bit there, but I think that has been in place for quite some time. I'll check with Mr. Watson and get back to you.
I got a follow-up question to that. We had two constitutions initially. Was this same language in both versions? I mean, I guess we got a homework assignment for you.
Okay, well.
Rhetorical question, that one.
The point is that we've been operating for 150 years on this principle, and I'm concerned that because of one situation in August of 2007 that we would think that maybe the system of 150 years suddenly doesn't work. So that is that's a concern of mine. I think we should tinker with the Constitution. It should be a very measured we shouldn't just react to a particular situation if there was an ongoing problem and it would happen over and over again and such. But it doesn't seem that that's the case. It sounds like this is traced going back to the bridge.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rust. Senator Thurlock, although I think that particular disaster was what piqued Representative Carlson's interest, I don't know that we couldn't look at other instances, tornadoes, the Browns Valley issue, where we would have perhaps the legislature may have wanted to call itself into special session. And I think what happened with that is, you ask the question, why can't we do that? And is it something extraordinary? Or is it a fairly common practice? And it turns out that the vast majority of states do have a provision for doing that. And on not every time they get in a snit, favorite word of mine lately, something that's going on with the governor, but they do have, 33 states do have a provision for the legislature to call itself into special session. And
does the NCSL have any information as to the frequency of special sessions called?
Yes. I have it here.
Different.
Yes. It's in the handout.
Studied over Easter break.
But they surveyed the legislatures. Let's see, when was this done? In February of 2000, asking in the past 10 years how many special sessions had been called, and of the total, how many were called by the legislature itself. And let's see. In Florida, for example, there have been 14 special sessions that have been called. 10 were by the governor, and they do allow presiding officers to call a special session. 4 were called by the president and the speaker. I think in Minnesota, if we went back to 1990, we probably have had, I would say probably almost one a year for some reason or another. So they have been frequently called. Some states, Idaho, hasn't had a special session since 1992, and only the governor can do that. In Illinois, this is a response from the Senate, the governor has convened the General Assembly in 9 special sessions since 1990. None has been called by the General Assembly, although they can. And the last time the leaders did that was in 1992. So there's a variety of experiences across the states that I'd be happy to share with you.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to address another one of the arguments made was about that we're one of it was only one of 17 states that don't have some sort of legislative initiative on this, or calling a special session. And my thought was that usually when we bolster our case, we're only one of 3 states in the country, or we're on one side or the other. It's not all that dramatic, I think, to say there's 17. That's kind of middle of the pack. So it's not really, it's kind of a mixed bag on both sides. And it's just interesting that when we use that argument, for example, we had...
It's 2/3. That's a pretty big number.
We had a bill in a committee just the other day about a particular chemical user. It was a bisphenol A. Some of us remember that from Jobs Committee. And there isn't a single place in the world, any governmental jurisdiction, that bans that. But it was saying that we should do this because we would be the leader in it. And then, of course, the flip side of that is people say we're the only state left. And, you know, so I guess we always use those arguments to bolster our case depending on which side of that we're on. And then I always think of the, you know, it's the kid who says, well, you know, 17 out of 50 kids mm-hmm. in my class get to go to Dairy Queen for whatever. And so.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, it's not a reason for doing it, but at least it is not extraordinary. And for the kid who wants to use the car because everybody else is doing it, that's not a good enough reason. Okay. However, he can say, well, Dad, it's a pretty common practice, even if you're going to say no. So I think pointing out that it's not extraordinary is not in and of itself a compelling reason to do it, but at least it indicates to us that we would not be out of sync with balance of power kinds of arguments that would be offered relative to the powers of the legislature and the governors in other states. It's not extraordinary. It's not in and of itself a compelling reason.
Senator Gerlach.
Since we mentioned extraordinary, the current, as I read it, the governor can call special session for extraordinary occasions, and that language is also reprinted in the bill. However, the legislative piece of that does not state for any reason at all. Now, obviously, extraordinary occasions is not defined, and that's mm-hmm. can be kind of anything. But we have a hurdle or a standard by which the governor can call a special session of the legislature for extraordinary occasions, but the legislature can do it for any reason. So there's a little imbalance there. I'm concerned about the line 114. It says a bill may be considered whose subject is stated in the agreement. Could that subject be education? I mean, how broad or narrow? Or does it have to just be, you know, disaster relief or what? It just says the subject, and that could pretty much be
Mr. Chairman,
anything.
Under arrest.
That's too limited.
Even though it is the case, at least in my opinion, that the Constitution of the United States is a extremely broad guiding document and is seldom amended, and we worry about how it is to be interpreted. Constitutions of the states are typically political documents, very political documents. They have things in them broad general principles in them like, how are you going to distribute the gas tax money? That's what we have in ours. They are not these broad principles under which we operate. Nevertheless, it seems to me in something like this that you would not want to be so specific that it would say that any bill, that you'd want a bill only, we can only call ourselves into special session if we wanted to raise the gas tax. I mean, that's not the kind of statement that we should put in the Constitution, and I think it's too bad, quite frankly, that that state constitutions, it's not just Minnesota's, but that state constitutions, and in some states they have state changes, total changes, not just amendments, but total changes almost routinely, you know, every 20 years or so they'll adopt a new constitution. We have not at least done that. But we have amended our constitution, Mr. Watson, how many times?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I don't know, but
over 100?
Could be.
Yes, I think it's over 100. And for things like how we're going to distribute money from the Trunk Highway Fund. I think this proposal at least rises above that. We have a question on the ballot about raising the sales tax. I mean, how political is that? Is that a broad policy initiative? No, it is not. This, it seems to me, does stay broad. It does stay general. It does not list a number of items on which a recipe for those conditions. How it tends to limit it, however, is by the length of days, and with Senator Roebling's amendment, which I think is a really good one, it has to be with broad agreement of the entire legislature.
Mr. Mayor?
Senator Gerlach.
Good point. You won me over on that, I should say, subject to that.
I'm sure you're going to vote no anyway.
I have one more question, Mr. Chairman. We talked briefly about this. The requirement is for a majority of members of each body. How, Senator Rest, how do we protect the rights of the minority? One party will always be in the majority,
right.
So you could have a caucus meeting and mm-hmm. decide that this is what you're going to do and shut out the minority. This is a big deal. How do you protect the rights of the minority?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've also thought about that because I didn't take this bill just kind of, it's a courtesy, like, okay, let me think about whether I want to pursue this or just leave it in the committee, quite frankly. And I don't know what number I would be prepared to put in there, but I think that's a good point to make, and whether it should be a supermajority of some kind. So it still may be all members of one party.
Could, but the likelihood is diminished.
The role of the minority could have an impact. As, for example, in the override of the governor's veto of the transportation bill, the two-thirds majority. So I actually think that would be a good policy amendment and to make sure that that we're not just talking about a political action by a party, but that we would have not unanimous consent, because that would be a tyranny of the minority, but one person could stop it from happening. But a supermajority of some sort, whether it would be 60% or the override is two-thirds?
Two-thirds. Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, and on the handout you gave us from NCSL, mm-hmm. I was just going along here circling the requirements, and 18 of those that let the legislature call themselves into session have a two-thirds minimum or greater, 18 of the states, in order to do that, two-thirds of the membership or greater. And several have three-fifths, and Maine here has a majority of members of each political party. So the standard is mm-hmm. is
Mr. Chairman,
higher than what
Senator
we're proposing.
Roebling, I guess I wouldn't go for the Maine one, but because that would also be a tyranny of the minority. But the notion of having some sort of supermajority, I think that's a good idea. Shall I offer that, or would you? What do you want to? Okay, Mr. Watson or Mr. Bodern.
Two-thirds.
How about
111?
Well, yeah. Okay, on line 111. How about upon written agreement of two-thirds of the members elected to the House of Representatives and two-thirds of the members elected to the Senate? Leave the rest of it alone, and then in the question to strike majority and say a majority and say of two-thirds of the members of each house of the legislature. That would be my motion, Mr. Chairman. I move that amendment.
Senator Rest moves that amendment. Council, did you get that? We're good on that. Everyone understand it? Any questions on that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Rest's amendment, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted.
Here we go. I don't have anything more that I would agree to being changed.
We now have the bill in shape before us. Senator Rest moves that Senate File 3072, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to Rules.
I believe so. There is a small fiscal impact, like $2,000.
So it'll have to go to Finance eventually, but Rules first.
Actually, it's being absorbed by that, and so there's no need for it to go to Finance.
Senator Rest's
just
motion.
To Rules.
Yes. Recommended to pass, referred to Rules. Anyone in the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 3072?
Afterwards.
Okay. Seeing none, we have Senator Rest's motion before us. Again, that Senate File 3072 be recommended to pass and referred as amended to the Rules Committee. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion?
I guess, even though there is that minimal impact, that Finance will want to see it eventually. We'll work on getting rid of the fiscal impact.
Motion carried. And
okay, Mr. Chairman, the next bill is Senate File 3576, and Senate File 3676 is an agency bill. And it has to deal with viral hemorrhagic septicemia. It is a health initiative from the DNR and was passed out of the Environment Committee. What it does is add VHS to the regulatory environment authority of the DNR. The reason why it is in this committee is because it does give to the DNR rulemaking in this specific area rather than just being able, they wanted that rather than their to be able to adopt rules under their general rulemaking authority. The rulemaking is on, let's see what.
On page 9.
The rulemaking, I would direct your attention to Section 14. The commissioner may, by rule, establish reasonable conditions on buying and selling of fish that would prevent or slow the spread of these diseases and invasive species.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Senator Robling and myself are trying to figure out what that word is. Can you tell it to us?
Which one?
Is there a common name for this?
VHS.
Senator Robling.
Oh, it's VHS.
That's what we call it. It's not a technology for videos. It's a viral hemorrhagic septicemia. And
fish disease.
Sounds delicious.
This is what it does to fish, and it's not yet in Lake Superior, or more accurately, it has not yet been discovered in Lake Superior. It may indeed already be there. It may come in the vector of ballast water. It may come more typically. It's going to come because a fisherman wanting to keep a fish alive brings that fish into Minnesota in a bucket of water. And that fish may be tainted and or the water. There might be indeed something in the water that would lead to infecting Minnesota's lakes. And so we're trying to get a jump on this before it wipes out a major industry and tourism activity. The DNR has met with fish farmers who had some real concerns about the bill, and I think most of them have been allayed. But you can see on the back of the brochure those places where there have been positive locations to this point of VHS. But it is just like other harmful invasive species, it is an ugly, ugly thing. And I mean, I think it just breaks your heart to see a fish bleeding to death like that. So that's the bill. Does it go to
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. And
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the DNR, and Senator Russ was asking if there was a fiscal implication. And we have done a fiscal note where we're saying there's no fiscal impact that can't be absorbed. We do have a separate VHS initiative in the governor's supplemental budget bill where we're seeking additional appropriations for surveillance, testing,
not
and treatment. But it's not. That's not related directly to this bill.
So, Mr. Chairman, my motion would be, when it's appropriate, that Senate File 3576 be recommended to pass, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Yeah. This is a little outside of the jurisdiction, but I remember my bait guys getting after me last year when we were working on part of this on page 6, lines 6 through 10 there. How many of our waters have been tested for VHS? You know, I mean, is this going to put a big...
It's for you, not me.
This came through the Environment Committee, correct? And
yes, it did.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, we're just in the process, and we have to test the fish in the waters, and we're in the process right now. We got a federal grant this fiscal year of $95,000 for surveillance, and so we're testing a number of lakes. We have to collect samples of fish, and there's a 28-day test, so it's a fairly involved testing process. There were a number of the bait folks that were at the Environment Committee hearing, and we had a follow-up meeting with the chairman of that committee and their representatives. And, you know, no one likes this, I think it would be fair to say, but right. There's kind of an understanding that it's necessary and reasonable, and we're committed to continue to work with them on the rules aspects and to try to make this as workable as possible. This is designed to try to prevent it from getting here, but there's a certain inevitability that it's headed this way, and so we want to be prepared when it gets here to be able to quickly adopt the rules to control its spread.
And it is, this is one of the things that is a disease. It's not just a species. It's not that. It is a disease, and it is highly contagious.
Okay. Any other questions of members?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
I'm sorry if I missed this, Senator Rest, but what are the what's the repealer? Section 21 on page 11.
The repealer is repeals someone being able to bring live minnows into the state for home aquariums. And that's a control measure, and it seems in some ways harsh, but I can't imagine a kid wanting to be responsible for the spread of VHS by minnows in a home aquarium. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions of members?
Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I'm just wondering, now it did say, and you pointed out this section on page 6, I think, so areas that have been tested and certified to not have disease can continue to sell minnows, and how extensive is that going to be, that the testing for that, and so that they know, because don't harvesters just go to various lakes and pull them out of there, and how is the DNR going to be testing for that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, we're fortunate we don't have VHS that we know of in Minnesota or are part of the Great Lakes at this time. The way we envision this working is if it's found here, then we'll do emergency rules and there will be notification, probably posting of those water bodies, and we'll restrict movement of fish out of those areas where it's found to any other water body. There could be some movement if it progresses like it has in some other states, and we find that the whole say, northeastern third of Minnesota has VHS, then there would be some movement allowed within the VHS positive area, but not outside the area. So it's going to be a process rather than an event that's going to happen statewide. If it's found in the state, then we'll start restricting movement of fish from that body of water, whether it's bait or commercial fish or whatever the body of water might be. If there's commercial activity, say it's the Mississippi River and it's positive for VHS, we would limit that gear being used, say, in inland waters.
It doesn't stop people fishing where VHS has been discovered. It's just you can't go from within VHS, you can go anywhere you want, even though the disease is there. It's just saying you can't cross the line. When there's no VHS, you can't take fish or minnows or bait from a VHS area into a non-VHS area because sure as shooting, it'll be there too. So it's a control measure.
Mm-hmm. Just one quick question. Senator Roebling.
What happens if people eat these sick fish?
Would you eat a fish that looked like that? No.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, this virus only affects fish and not people, so there's no human health risk with this disease, but it isn't something that you I mean, if it was a die-off of fish, they look pretty bad, and I don't think anyone would be eating it. We certainly wouldn't recommend it, but this virus does not affect people.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's another unrelated question, but I'm just curious if where the VHS experience has occurred, has there been also evidence that it's hurt local economies as it relates to that disease? I mean, people just not fishing those lakes anymore, and it seems to me that there could be some ripple effect. And if it infects the lake, what percentage of the lake fish do we see it in, or is it all the fish?
Mr. Chair and Senator Larson, there have been some significant die-offs of different species. This disease affects a wide variety of species, and the list is growing, but most of the game fish species are affected, and there have been some major die-offs of those species. We don't have enough history yet to know if there's going to be a resistance within those populations that will allow them to recover. But initially, when it shows up, there can be very large die-offs within a lake of whether it's bass or walleye or trout. And so there could be some significant economic impacts with this disease if it, I don't know if people are going to be afraid to go there. There's, like I said, there's not a human health threat, but if the fish population's so reduced that they're not expecting to catch very much, then they'll probably go somewhere else.
Thank you.
Any other questions of members?
So, Mr. Chairman, I would, unless there's anybody else who wants to testify.
We'll ask. Senator Rust moves that Senate File 3576 be, as amended, be recommended to pass. Anyone in the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 3576? Seeing none, we have Senator Rust's motion before us. All those in favor of this motion, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And I voted yes.
Mr. Chairman, you may adjourn the committee.
Being no further action before this committee, state and local government stands adjourned. Thank you, members.